Hi, I'm a scientist at MIT. My background is on instrumentation for gravitational waves. I've joined the LIGO laboratory exactly 10 years ago today, and I did my PhD in Italian-French gravitational wave detectors, Virgo. So the first part of my talk would be on behalf of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, the broader community of scientists who work with the LIGO data. And the first part will be on a brief reminder of advanced LIGO performance during the first observing run 01, and a description of how we're doing now in the second observing run 02. Get used to these acronyms, 01 and 02, we'll be repeated them several times. The second part of my talk is not on behalf of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. It is an informed guess of what you should expect in the near future and what the community is thinking right now to go beyond advanced LIGO sensitivity. Okay. So the LIGO laboratory, on behalf of the National Science Foundation, operates the two largest gravitational wave observatories in the world. They're both located in the United States. One is in Washington State, the other one is in Louisiana. Each observatory has a 4-kilometer L-shaped ultra-high vacuum system, and each of these facilities hosts a detector. So we call the detector in Hanford the H1 detector, the one in Lewiston is the L1 detector. So O1 and O2 are the run, H1 and L1 are the detectors, and those are hopefully all the acronyms I'm going to use today. This facility has been built at the end of the 90s, and the first generation of detectors, called the LIGO detectors, have been operational since 2010. Probably you haven't heard much about it because there was no detection of gravitational waves reported. In 2010, the facility remained the same, but all the components of the detectors inside were replaced with a more powerful detector we call advanced LIGO, the second generation of gravitational wave interferometers. Those are the famous detectors that made the discovery during O1. You're all familiar with the first observing run O1 and the GW150914 event. So my talk would be about advanced LIGO performance, but advanced LIGO are not the only detectors in the world. Duncan will talk more about this, but I just want to point out our friends. There is a 600-meter detector, so significantly shorter than advanced LIGO in Germany, and GEO. GEO has been operational for many years and is still operational. There are two other 3-kilometer detectors in the world. One is in Italy, where I started, in Virgo, and the other one is in Japan, Skagra. They're both 3-kilometer. The optical configuration is similar to advanced LIGO, except the length of the arms. The main difference is that all the detectors are on surface except Skagra, which is underground. It's located in the Kamioka mine, close to the Kamiokande experiment. It's actually a pretty cool place to visit. So Duncan will give you more details about these detectors. You probably heard about LIGO India. So there is the proposal, which has now been accepted, to build a third LIGO detector in India as well. So Duncan will tell you more about those. OK, so let me start with the noise performance of the detectors during O1. I think you're all familiar by now with this curve, but just so let me just say again. So this is the main figure of merit of our instruments. We plot the strain noise versus frequency. The strain noise is the detector noise expressed in equivalent gravitational wave strain units. And the amplitude of the waves is H. So you can think of this in different ways. For people who work in the instrument, we think about noise. It's a bad thing, and so you need to reduce it as much as possible. So these curves need to go down. The down is good, up is bad. And just to put it in context, The green trace here is the initial LIGO detectors that hold the operation until 2010. The gray curve is advanced LIGO design. This is what we came up when we designed advanced LIGO based on what we call fundamental noises. This is what we think those detectors should be able to do when they operate at full sensitivity. And so we refer to this curve here as advanced LIGO design. The blue trace and the red trace are the sensitivities, or better, the noise of H1 and L1 during the first observing run. So here's what we see. Now, I think this is clear to you, but just let me state again. So this noise, you can, given your favorite source, you can translate the noise of the instrument as the maximum distance at which you can see your favorite source. Now, because the actual detection rate, so many events you see, if you assume a uniform distribution of your sources, the detection rate scales with the volume. So every small improvement in the sensitivity, even if it's 10%, in terms of detection rate, you scale with the cube. And so that's why people like me work on the instruments are really passionate about trying to take time with the interferometer not observing, because we want to improve the noise and make it lower. And that's the point. So then the total observable volume of your universe is really the product between, you know, the cube of the distance times the time that you are observing. And so those are the two important parameters. So the take-home message here is that O1 sensitivity was the best sensitivity ever seen for decades. It was 3 to 5 times better than initial detectors. Depends exactly on which frequency, but it's still not as good as we think we can make it. And so the old concept for advanced LIGO was, well, we will start observing as soon as we have a sensitivity that is better than before, even if it's not optimal, and then we will keep improving the detectors until we reach advanced LIGO design. So that was the overall plan.
Is that the strain noise or the amplitude spectral density?
This is the amplitude spectral density. It's taken from the paper, but that's all what it is. So Vicky, I wasn't here, so I'm sorry I missed the talk, but Vicky gave a nice introduction what the science of advanced LIGO, the first observing run, was. Here, I just want to take some useful information from this plot. So on the left panel, this is the noise of the instrument. And on top of those, there are these traces that correspond to the events observed by advanced LIGO during O1. So the blue one is the most famous. It's GW150914. It's the first one. Very big signal. The plot on the right shows you the time that this signal has been in the advanced LIGO band, starting from 30 Hertz. And the traces here, the colors correspond to each other. So blue is GW150914, orange is the second event in December, green is a candidate. So significance is not strong enough to be declared an event, but it is 87% astrophysical. Just Duncan remind me the number a second ago. These traces are put here such that the area between the trace and the noise is representative of the signal-to-noise ratio of the signals. So the point here is that these signals enter the LIGO band around, let's say, 30 Hertz. And then, depending on the masses of the instrument, they merge at different frequencies. So GW150914, the mass is very heaviest, and they merge around 250 Hertz. The other ones stay in band longer and merged later, but here the signal to noise is lower, so you cannot resolve very well the spiral and merge, the merger ring bound phase. So the point is, the lower the noise, the better you can extract information about your parameters. So here is a comparison, you can see a bit better, comparison between Hanford H1 and Livingston L1 during the first observing run. You see the high frequency performance For us, high frequency means above 100 Hz. The high frequency performance is pretty similar. Below 100 Hz, there's a difference. It seems small, but it's actually significant in terms of equivalent distance, which you can see an event. And Livingston was doing a little bit worse than Hanford. Okay, so before I move on, and just to give you a sense of the type of work that we do on the instrument to make it better, this is a simplified sketch of how the interferometers inside the vacuum system actually look like. You probably are used to think about LIGO as a Michelson interferometer, which is true, but not quite. It's more complicated than that. So here is your laser. It's a 1064 nanometer laser. And Michelson will have, you know, the beam splitter and the two end mirrors. Instead, what we do, we are actually using Fabry-Perot cavity in the arms, which is equivalent to recycle the light, so you send it back and forth, and this enhances your sensitivity to gravitational waves. We have a laser system that is able to output up to 125 watts inside the interferometer, but during O1, we were running it at a much lower power, so between 20 and 25 watts. So those are resonant cavities, so you're actually recycling the light inside the arms. So inside the arms, we had something like 100 kilowatt laser power, and this is roughly 7 times lower than what we think advanced LIGO can achieve. The mirrors are suspended with a very performing and complicated system, an active seismic isolation on the top, and there is a quadrupole pendulum attached to the bottom of this system. Those are the last two stages of the system. Those are the mirrors. Those are 40 kilogram fused silica, super high quality mirrors, and they are coated to give us the very high reflectivity for 1064 nanometer. They are 34 centimeter in diameter, so you're looking at objects like this. It's pretty big. Something that usually doesn't make it to the overview talks on the science result is how complicated these instruments are. So in order to make interferometer operate like a gravitational wave detectors, you need to keep the light resonant in the arms and the Michelson on the dark fringe. So simply put, there is no light leaving this photo detector, reaching the photo detector, so it's dark fringe in a steady state. When the gravitational wave arrives, the space-time is distorted, and that's equivalent to moving the mirrors this way, and you get a change in interference pattern on this detector that looks like this, and that's your gravitational, and that signal has encoded the property of your gravitational wave. Again, it's not like the interferometer like a light resonant in the arms by itself. You need to control the mirrors to actually make it do that. And that means controlling the mirrors both in length, like relative distance between each other, and also angles, like you need to point the mirrors to each other very well. The accuracy required is incredible, and that's why this is hard to do. If you are familiar with control system, we have something like 300 control loops running constantly to make this possible. And control loops are, or control system in general, famous because they do what you want in some band, but they introduce noise in some other band. And so that's also something that we face every day when we want to minimize the noise of your instrument. Bottom line is, in your output of the main output of the interferometer, you get the noise from the instrument plus the gravitational wave signal. So minimizing the noise is what makes you win. Okay, sorry, I thought this introduction was a bit longer than I wanted it to be, but I hope so it's clear, we can move on. So we quantify the noise of our instrument typically by plotting the same curves that you've seen before, but calibrated in a more familiar units of meters. So this is displacement. The relation is actually very simple because the amplitude of the gravitational waves of your strain is displacement noise divided by the length of the arm. So there is only a 4 kilometer scale factor between what we call amplitude spectral density or strain and the displacement noise. So what you see in this plot is the red trace is the total measured noise of the instrument. So this is exactly the same curve that you've seen before. On top, there are a bunch of other curves that express what I just said. So what are the noise sources that makes the total noise of your instrument? And so here, I point out a few of them. This is actually a simplified plot, and later I will show you more of the details that goes into this. So you start with the seismic noise. So this is, doesn't actually make it to be a significant contribution because we have larger noise sources, but this is the limit imposed by your seismic and suspension isolation system. This is essentially how much the meter moves. And we call 10 Hertz the wall because below that, there isn't much you can do on Earth, let's say. With the even more complicated system, we could push it down maybe by another factor of 10, but it's very hard to do. So seismic noise here. This green trace here is thermal noise. I told you meters have coatings on them. Because the measurements we are trying to do is so precise, the motion of the molecules of the coatings are actually enough to create an equivalent to displacement noise that masks a gravitational wave. Quantum noise, this blue trace here. So this is directly related to how much light you store in your system. This part is shot noise, so it's the uncertainty on the arrival time of the photons of your photodetectors. This is actually not real displacement noise in the sense that the mirror don't move because of this noise, but is a limitation on the precision of your measurement. So the important thing here is that the quantum noise goes down as the square root of the power in the arm. So the more power you put in your system, the lower this goes, and it goes with the square root of the power. You increase the power by a factor of 2, you gain a square root of 2. So that's the basic math here. Now, the elephant in the room is this green trace, and this trace is technical noise. So all the control systems that I've described before that are needed to keep the interferometer working are here. Now, if you're paying attention and you look at and you do the sum of the quantum noise, that is the main noise here, and the gray trace, you see there is a gap between the noise that we understand, so like those are things that we expect to be there, and the noise that we actually measure. So usually we call this mystery noise, but it's not a mystery that we have this mystery noise. It's always been like that. The amount of noise sources that affect this instrument below 100 Hertz is huge. And so we think we are smart and we know all of them, but there's always some that we don't actually know. And for the initial detectors, it was essentially the same thing. You start and you have a gap between what you measure and what you understand, and then as you move on, you reduce this gap. The high frequency part is pretty well understood, and it's directly correlated with how much light you send in. Okay.
Before you move on, how much you can move the seismic noise away from the photon to go underground, like with Kagra?
That's a good question. The reality is not by much.
By not much, like order of magnitude or factor of two?
I think it's more like, maybe you have it in your plot, but I think it's,
yeah, it's Kagra, more. Kagra is on the ground because there's not a lot of land in Japan. It's not far enough on the ground. Like, it's not ET on the ground where you get the load.
Okay, yeah. So let's put a question for ET. Factor of two? Just wait.
Let's say that going, in general, going underground, the strongest motivation for going underground is space availability. There are some advantages, that's true, but the strongest driver is that. Okay, sorry, I think this is taking me forever, but I enjoy this a lot, so I'll keep going, unless you stop me. So very briefly then, observing Run 01, it's started in September 2015, ironically a few days before the GW 1509-14 event. We were all surprised. Some quick number. So the two LIGO detectors were operational for four calendar months, from September to January. I mentioned earlier, the noise of your instrument is not the only important variable. The other variable is the duty cycle, the uptime, and more importantly, the coincident uptime of your two interferometers. So here are the numbers for O1, 62% uptime for H1, 55% for L1, combined is 43%. So that means, obviously, if you have a month of data, it's really very useful. It's, let's say, almost half of that. Overall, 51 days of coincident time, and then after some data quality analysis, it was reduced to 48.6. The interesting thing, and that's why I put this slide here, is to give a sense, the product of observable volume and measurement time during O1 exceeded that of all previous runs that happened in the previous 10 years combined in 16 days. And so that stresses the importance of reducing your noise. Advanced LIGO was 3 to 4 times lower noise than initial LIGO, but because of the cube factor that you gain, the chances of detection were way higher, and that's what made possible to make the first detection of gravitational waves. Okay, now, this is actually what I want to talk about, which is what happened after O1. Again, I told you that was always the idea. You take data for a while, and then you stop, improve the detector, and move on, and take more data. So since O1, we had 10 months of commissioning time at both sites between January and October 2016. There were the main activities at both sites were the following. So H1, the main goal was to increase the laser power. Told you quantum noise goes down at the square root of the power. So the goal was to increase the power, well, as much as possible, but something like of the order of a factor of 2. And that required, somehow, when I started working on gravitational wave detectors, I thought that increasing the power was a knob. Like, you change a knob and the power goes up and that's it. But you learn very quickly that that's not how it works. They're actually very difficult to do. And the main reason, there are essentially three reasons. One is that even if your mirrors are extremely high quality, there is still some absorption. And the more power you put in, the more lens in your mirrors you get. And if you don't compensate properly for this lens, you are destroying the quality of your beam shape and nothing works. The other thing is the alignment system becomes much more difficult when you have the more light in the system, and that's because the radiation pressure noise becomes the classical radiation pressure noise becomes comparable to the mechanical restoring torque of the pendulum. And one of the things that we, especially in Hanford, we suffered a lot is what's called parametric instability. I won't talk about this. It's another complication that you get when you try to operate a machine with a lot of power in, essentially. So that's first for Hanford. For Livingston, the plan was the same, with the caveat that it was a failed attempt in the sense that the laser system failed. So we didn't get a chance to actually put more light in the system. If you have questions, I can talk more about this later. So then the focus was shifted on mitigation of scattered light noise. Scattered light noise is the nightmare of gravitational wave detectors. All of the gravitational waves detectors in the world. We thought we learned our lessons from the initial detectors, and we did the best we could to fix that, but apparently there's still more fixing to be done. Scattered light means you have light. You saw pretty much what the path of light is, but the reality is way more complicated than that. You have ghost beams in your system. If spurious light from the interferometer reaches any surface that is not extremely well isolated, light finds its way back to the interferometer. And that creates a modulation of light, which is a noise source. And so scattered light noise needs to be very well mitigated. So that was one of the main things. And the other was to improve the robustness of the instruments like the uptime. So all of this happened. We transitioned engineering run in November 2016. So this is the sensitivity. Typical sensitivity means, as usual, one of the best sensitivity. So again, amplitude spectral density here of your strain, so H and versus frequency. So here I will then compare, because those curves are similar, I will then compare later with respect to O1. But so those are same color code. Red is Amford, Livingston is in blue. And now you see things swapped. So now Livingston is better than Hanford. High frequency, pretty much the same, but this is better. Low frequency, the Livingston is now better than Hanford. So now, this is the same plot, but so red is still Hanford during O1, and purple is what it was during, red is during O2, and purple is what the sensitivity was during O1. Now, to see the difference, you need to look close, but you can do that. So here is, you see that Amford actually did better at high frequency in O2 than during O1. This was due to the fact that this laser power increase work brought to about 30% more power on the arm. And so, and then you gain a factor, you gain as the square root of the power increase, it's about 10% improvement. At low frequency, the noise is worse. Now, if you look at this plot, you wouldn't think that's so different, but that's actually enough to reduce the range by about a factor of 10. Now, the reason for that is not totally well understood. We can talk more in the questions later. For Livingston instead, what you see, there was no power increase at high frequency, so the high frequency is pretty much the same. But the low frequency is improved. Now, blue is O2, cyan is O1, and you see the difference here, that's mostly due to mitigation of scattered light noise. And that created a significant improvement in the range of the order of 20%. So now, this is a noise budget for the L1 sensitivity, similar to the one that I showed you before. So now we moved from strain to noise in displacement, so meter, but it's pretty much the same thing. And now here there are more noise sources, like the old technical noise curve that I had before. There are more contributions, but the bottom line is that even with this improved sensitivity at low frequency for Livingston, there is still a gap between what you measure, that's here in blue, and the sum of all your known noise sources in gray. So there is still a gap. It's lower than what we had in H1, which was the best instrument during the first observing run, but the gap is still there. Okay, very quickly, O2 is still ongoing. It was started in November. There was a scheduled break over the holidays. 30 days of coincidence data have been collected up to February 23rd. And I want to mention here that there was a significant improvement in the duty cycle in the last 2 months. So now the uptime of the two instruments is very close to 50%. That was due to work on the instrument and the fact that we had a very bad seismic environment at both sites in December and January, and now things are getting better, and we became smarter as well. So the improvement is significant. Won't talk about the candidates because Duncan will talk about this. Duration of O2, the original idea was to have six calendar months of data. So starting in December, that will mean end of May. There is a proposal to actually extend the run to the end of August for several reasons that I can discuss later if you're interested. This is not official yet. There is a pending decision of the LIGO operation management team, but at this point seems very likely that O2 will go through the end of the summer. Again, Duncan will talk about this, but there is a planned transition from two LIGO detectors to network to a three detector network that includes Virgo. This, again, not a final decision yet. Virgo is wrapping up their commissioning phases, so they should be operational in a few months. Okay, what's coming after O2? So this week we enter the informed guess scenario, so I'm leaving the official talk from the LIGO collaboration, and this is my view. Okay, so commissioning will start after the end of O2 for about a calendar year, possibly longer. Sorry, it's not going to happen in 1 minute. Just telling you. I won't try to go too fast because. So what's going to happen next? Fire mitigation of scattered light. There is never enough work on mitigation of scattered light. So I'm guessing this will, as we learn more, there will be more work happening after every run. Laser power increase at both sites. This time we hope for real, in the sense that we have a simpler laser system that we think will be easier to operate. And at this point we have learned a lot about how to control the interferometry diode power in Hanford, so we have high expectation that this will be successful. There is another activity that I'm actually, this is one of the main things that I'm doing these days at MIT, which is using quantum optics technologies as a complementary approach to reducing quantum noise as increasing the laser power. I won't talk about that, but if you're interested, this is really exciting, and so I would be happy to discuss it. What this could bring us. So again, same plot, frequency. This is projections, unofficial projections for L1 noise after O2. So the blue trace is what we have now. Red is what you get if you double the power. And cyan is what you get on top of that if not you only increase the power, but you also do squeezing, some modest amount of squeezing injection. This is what you would get. And each step will give you something of the order of 12% noise reduction. And because you cube it, that's actually significant. So if you use the standard binary neutron star range figure of merit, you go from currently, this is the very best, 95 megaparsec, the very best we've ever seen. You go to 120 megaparsec. And this, we hope this could be the sensitivity for O3, so like when we start the next observing run. In some sense, this is a conservative projection. Everything needs to go well at high frequency, but it's conservative because here I'm assuming there won't be any improvement in the low frequency band, which hopefully is not true, because we will do work to actually improve it. So the expectation is that we can actually do better than this. So just to wrap all of this up, I told you at the beginning, this has always been the plan. You start with some noise performance, you try to make it better, take more data, and you repeat. And so this was the observing plan that the LIGO and Virgo collaboration published together. I think we made these curves in 2014, guessing what the progression would be, where black is the advanced LIGO design sensitivity. And so here I superimpose on this plot what we have done and what we think we will do. So you see the observing run 01 was actually extremely positive, like it was at the very best of what we think we would be doing at that time. This is also a reason why now the sensitivity improvement between 01 and 02 hasn't been so good. It's just we did very well in 01. And so the O2 curve is in green. You see this is the improvement of Livingston at low frequency here. And O3, this is the curve that I just showed you with power increase plus squeezing. this is what could be. And again, hopefully, here I've assumed that low frequency noise is the same, but hopefully we will enter this band here. Now, we already know that most likely O3 won't happen in 2017 because we are pushing O2 to the end of the summer, and then we want to take several months to actually take data. So there won't be an O3 starting in 2017. So it will be pushed to 2018, 2019. There is not an official decision yet, but the idea is to have a quite long run of the order of 9, 12 months for O3. So if you put all together, this is what it would look like. And so this is time, and this is a 1, or 2, or 3 sequence with binary neutron star ranges. This is what we did in O1. This is what O2 looks like. And this is the target for O3. And with the curves that I show you, we're actually at 120 megaparsec. Again, we have good expectations. This would actually be better than that. And then we'll keep doing that, but then the future becomes more and more unclear because it depends what we will find in the instrument. Okay, so unfortunately, you think this is a conclusion, but it's only the first part of the conclusion. So overall, O2 is doing well. The duty cycle is improving. The instruments are performing well. The sensitivity improvement with respect to O1 was not as large as we hoped. One reason is because we did very well in O1, and so doing better in a short period of time is not easy. But the good thing is we found promised direction during the commissioning work before O2. And so now we are building the hardware that we think will help fixing the problems that we have seen. And so for O3, we do target a significant sensitivity improvement. Now, I think Duncan will talk more about rates and yeah, okay, yeah, that's it. Yeah, sounds good. So, great. So the first question that someone should ask me, though, is what's coming next beyond advanced LiDAR?
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Okay.
So, in your opinion, what will be the biggest roadblock to reach design sensitivity, full design sensitivity?
I think for the high frequency performance above 100 Hz, we have squeezing, and that can help us to reach the advanced LIGO design, even if we don't use the full power. We're learning that operating at full, high power is hard, even if we don't succeed in doing that, we have squeezing. So the high frequency, I think, is fine. We'll reach that. Low frequency, if we can't figure out what this mystery noise is, I think for all the other noise sources that we do understand and we put on our plots, we have a path forward for how to reduce it. But the one that we don't know about, so if you can, one of the worst things that could happen is if, for example, something in, I don't necessarily think that this is likely, but if something in the old seismic and suspension system is introducing some unexpected noise source, then it would be very hard because we have, many meters that needs to suspend it in that way, and that would require a lot of work. Those are the big scary things that can happen.
I wanted to ask about some of the noise sources. So yeah. In the first plot you showed you had the thermal noise and the seismic noise having this peak together at low frequencies. So what's the physics behind that? Why they peak together on the first one you showed?
Yeah, this one you're saying.
That one, the brown and the green curve peak at about 10 hertz.
Oh, this is just one of the resonance mode of the system. Of the suspension system, it's a system of pendulums, so this is one of the mode of your chain.
Oh, okay.
And that's pretty but simple.
So the thermal does that as well? That's my
thermal noise is it's a fundamental noise in the sense that is so this part here is due to the mechanical loss of the of your coatings, and so that enters at the noise scales at the square root of the loss. And that's what is limiting. So in order to beat the, I mean, in order to make this green curve disappear, you would have to make coatings that have very, very low mechanical loss. That's the most important part here.
Oh, so in your first plot with design sensitivity expectation, there is a little peak somewhere in the middle frequency range. So I was curious as to what is it supposed to be. It was very at the beginning.
Oh, I think you're meaning the 500 Hz. That's just one of the violin mode of the suspension. It's sometimes we remove it in the design. So, you know, the mirrors are suspended by glass wires, fibers, and there is a violin mode of that system, and that shows up at 512 Hz. And sometimes in the design is still there. Wait, no one asked me about the beyond advanced light.
Well, actually, I have a quick question as well. So on the, of course, it's very hard to say where the mystery noise came from for obvious reasons. But could you say a little bit about what you're trying to do to discover it and to mitigate it?
Yeah. So several things. One is like searching for scattered light noise in that region. The way in which you do that is you shake things, so you intentionally amplify the noise that couples into your system and try to see if there are sources that maybe they're not big enough to be above the noise, but they're close enough that if you sum them all together, they do it. So that's one. The other one is we are investigating, so the actuators in which we push on the mirrors are electric static driver. And so if you have electric field around them that varies over time, that could be a mechanism. We have excluded that, but that's also another direction. There is always the possibility that, you know, the control noise is actually maybe changing over time, and so you think you know it well, but then at some point it's increasing. We also don't think it's that. So we have been doing the list of, one of the other things is jitter from the laser, like if the beam moves as it enters the interferometer and you have a misalignment of your interferometer that couples in as noise. So we have done extensive characterization. We understand that noise as causing some of the peaks at high frequency for Hanford right now, but it doesn't look like it's big enough to contribute at low frequency. So the list is pretty long.
So Lisa, one of the things that's probably of interest in the massive stars community is mapping out the masses and spins of compact objects so we can figure out stellar evolution models. Do you think it would be possible with future detectors to build something that could, I don't know, see all the compact binaries within Z of 100?
Whoa!
Set up.
Thank you! Great. Okay. So near-term vision for, very quickly, near-term vision for an advanced LIGO. We think we can push current technologies with more and better squeezing and better coatings to get a factor of 2 increasing range over advanced LIGO design. That means a factor of 5 in rate. Plans for what we call A+, ramping up. And then even looking farther ahead, we think we can do new technologies and new facility, which means maybe changing material, changing frequency of the laser, wavelength of light, get better coating, and build essentially longer detectors. We have a 4 kilometer scale detector right now. There is a concept in Europe to do a 10 kilometer triangular shaped detector underground. It's called ET. There is another concept that is forming now in the United States. We call it Cosmic Explorer. This will be on the surface L-shaped up to 40 kilometer. And the question that Duncan said is that, so that this is a Photoshop picture of what it could look like if you keep going. this is the plot that Duncan is referring to. So we are starting to see what's the physics that we could do with this 40 kilometer scale detector. And so here you see a plot of redshift and total mass. And so the interesting thing is the orange curve is Cosmic Explorer, and you see that you could get to incredibly high redshifts for a wide range of total mass. And that the summary is that with Cosmic Explorer, we could actually detect all of the complex binaries in the universe. So we are very excited, and we would like the broader community to actually help us build a science case for these detectors. So we think this would be essentially a real opportunity for all of us to learn more about the universe.
So, okay, Duncan is setting up. While Duncan is setting up, there is time for one last quick question. Yair, did you still want to ask?
I was just going to ask what's next. So.
Perfect.
Thank you, and now you're all friends.
All right, thank you very much again, Lisa.
Sorry, it took so long.